Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Chico children's book author Josh Shelton has spent much of his life as a contractor building custom homes, but has always been attracted to the arts like poetry, drawing, and music. Josh views children as our greatest teachers, and he created a series of books he calls I Am Adventure. The third in this series, Just Be, is illustrated by Sam Pulenza. Its rhyming message is designed for children, but we adults can benefit from the reminder to just be. Josh Shelton, welcome.
No, thank you so much for having me. Excited to be here.
Now, I just mentioned that the reminder to just be, because that's the title of your third book in this series.
Yeah, that's correct. It's quite a concept. And like you said, I think it's a children's book for sure, but we're all, you know, have an inner child. And then this message is pretty much for, well, it was for me at first, and some, you know, for everybody.
Well, you have an illustrator, and for children's books, the illustrators are really important because that's what the children see. Mm-hmm. So who was your illustrator? I mentioned his name. But
yeah, Sam Pulenza. So he's a lifelong friend of mine. We've come and gone, and we share a deep connection and a love for the arts, you know, and the planet, and just all things. And, you know, this is about 6-7 years ago that we kind of reacquainted, if not longer. I think it's been about 5 years since released the second book. You know, the world kind of went a little bit bonkers there for a bit, and so we got a little sidetracked, but we refocused. And yeah, I mean, he, you know, those that get a chance to see the book or his paintings, you know, his artistry is in my opinion virtually second to none. So, you know, and I have always written and drawn and done plenty of art myself, but I had, you know, this idea to, you know, lots of poetry. And we just kind of met up one day, and it just kind of, the idea came into being, like an idea whose time had come. And yeah, the creative process is quite exciting how, you know, when you see this finished book, what you don't see is the archive materials of this thing was done almost 2 or 3 times because we just get this idea. And then we'd have to change that. And then just the creative process has really been, oh man, just life-giving, and it's so fun. And yeah, the illustrations speak for themselves. They kind of come to life, and the color, and he really perfectly together manifested my vision for the poetry and the story and the message. You know, it's multifaceted. The illustrations just bring it to life.
This is children's book author, Chico children's book author, Josh Shelton, and he's referring to his illustrator, Sam Pulenza. So I'm assuming that you wrote all the story in poetry form.
Correct.
And then you and Sam probably sat down, and Sam said, well, what do you think about this? And
correct.
The illustrations.
Yeah, we set it up almost like, you know, originally it's like you set it up in grids like a comic book, and you just get concepts, and then one thing leads to another, and it's quite a creative process. Like I said, sometimes your amazing idea, you know, down the road, it's like, oh, nope, the idea led to an even better idea. So you have to be willing to not be attached to things and let it go. And really, the filter process, like the cream rises to the top when you get something that is what I feel is a really awesome piece of work.
You just said something, too, in passing. You said, let it go.
Yeah.
And I think there's another message to let go when the time is to let go of something.
Yeah, let go to
so
get it.
There's another lesson right there.
Big time.
Now, since you mentioned the illustration, the cover, why don't you describe the cover for us, Josh?
Well, this is kind of a special cover. So the cover, you know, Just Be, it's got a bulldog, which has been a very special animal in my family. Specifically, my dad has had bulldogs. The book is dedicated to all of his bulldogs.
I noticed. Eight bulldogs.
Yeah, he gets credit for some bulldogs that my brother had or maybe my grandma had that basically end up liking him as much, if not more. So any bulldog that comes to the family is his ends up being his. So, yeah, it has a bulldog, Bula, or Tiger, or any one of these 8 bulldogs, you could call them, laying, just being along the front, along a nice patch of grass. And on the words Just Be, there's a little hamster balancing himself on a few rocks, and his wheels temporarily taking a break, hanging from the T in the word. just. And that's kind of, you know, this book kind of encapsulates those two characters, kind of represent the hamster, the busy-brained hamster, you know, spinning around in his head, just can't stop thinking. And, you know, the heart-centered bulldog is just, you know, constantly following this little critter around, just trying to get him to hang up the wheel.
You know, I never thought really about children having a busy mind, but I know as an adult, well, I hope I'm better now, but your image of the mind being like a hamster on a wheel.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what's on your cover. You just were saying it's depicted. The little hamster's wheel is hanging off one of the letters in the title, and there's a little hamster balancing himself on some rocks, a stack of rocks.
Yeah, well, that's the irony of it all, is you're absolutely right. I mean, as we nowadays, kids' minds are busier than they were, like, in my youth because of, you know, just this, the instant gratification. You know, you see a lot of kids with phones in their faces, and they're too young. And but you're right. You know, they have less experience or been around to have their brains develop. When you're younger, yeah, the concept of needing these teachings is a little bit more relevant when you're older, like for the adult, for sure. But it does not, the kids as well. I mean, everyone needs to learn to be able to just be.
My guest is children's author Josh Shelton. And his third in a series, the series is called I Am Adventure. The third is entitled Just Be. And you've mentioned children, and you speak from experience because you have two of your own.
Yeah, I have two wonderful children. Well, one of them is now an adult, but, you know, once they're your kids, they're always your kids. And, yeah, they've always been my largest inspiration. And, you know, just raising them in this world, you could see how, you know, some of the stuff that they are up against, it's different than, it was hard enough, you know, growing up's hard, you know, living can be hard. I guess it all depends on perspective, but seeing some of the battles and stuff they face and just, you know, growing up in this world, it was just my, I guess, if for nothing else, some of this is just to try to help make a difference, specifically for our kids.
Well, you could have written this story without making it rhyme, Josh.
That
was extra effort on your part.
Yeah.
So why did you write your story in rhyme?
I've always written poetry. I've written a lot of music. I used to play, you know, I still play, but not as often as I like to. But that
so
was
So you
my,
play an instrument?
Yeah, guitar. Yeah, and drums or whatever instruments in front of me I'll learn, but guitar is kind of my baby. So yeah, that was my outlet younger, writing and, you know, rhyming. And just general poetry is kind of an outlet for me. A lot of these stories, they just come through me like a concept, and it'll just kind of open up, and it, for whatever it's worth, this does not take me long to write. It was more like a download, you know, all of them. The fourth one coming down the road, which we won't get into now, that's already written. So, yeah, it's playful, it's adventurous, it's a fun way to tell a story. Sometimes, you know, you get lost with this particular book. The illustrations are so fantastic that sometimes you lose the poetry component because you stall out on all the pages. So that we did add the poetry page at the back of all the books.
That's convenient because as an adult, once they get through reading this story and looking at the pictures with their child, they can, at the very last page, read this for, I think, themselves.
Yeah, 100%.
Oh, here's a reminder. I need to reread this every day, I think.
Yeah, no doubt. I couldn't agree more. And I, you know, you just have to hope it gets into the hands. And as the parents are reading their young one, their children's book, they're probably getting hit with like, wow, this is kind of maybe for me.
So while the children are looking, these illustrations are very colorful, just beautiful. The listeners can't see the photographs, but they can hear your poetry. So, Josh, I'm going to ask you to read Just Be.
Yeah, I'll give it a read, and I'll just read it through in poem form, so that way I don't get sidetracked staring at some of these amazing art forms. So Just Be. Have you ever seen a hamster run on its wheel? Well, that's how the thoughts in my mind often feel. It seems in the morning that after my rest, my thoughts are at ease and my mind's at its best. But when I'm tuckered out after a long, busy day, the thoughts, they keep coming. They won't go away. Just think. For hundreds upon hundreds of minutes each day, our minds are at work in so many ways. I've found myself wondering from time to time if my thoughts are like visitors visiting my mind. My thoughts create whether or not they are said. I must become mindful of what hangs out in my head. It stands to reason that during my sleep, I'm still, I'm quiet, and breathing quite deep. So perhaps in between all the learning and play, I can do like I sleep, but in an awake sort of way. It's totally obvious. It'll be easy. You'll see. I'll take time in my day to simply just be. What if I'm busy as the bees without a minute to spare? Well, then I'll just be for 59 seconds and breathe in the fresh air. And if during my breathing a few thoughts stop on by, I will greet them and thank them and bid them goodbye. Let's see. What can I do throughout my day to keep yucky thoughts from visiting my way? I can stroll into nature for a minute or two, perhaps barefoot, yes. I'll kick off my shoes. I can lay on my back for a minute or three and find shapes in the clouds as they float above me. I can lean on a tree for a minute or four. If a friend comes to visit, I'll stay a few minutes more. I can sit by a fire for an hour or five, and I'll ponder the miracle of being alive. Within stillness, I find a land beyond time where all is at peace in my soul. As I gaze toward the moon and the stars up above, the miracle fills my heart full. Whatever lay before me, be it work, rest, or play, mindful I shall be as I dance through my day. What do you say? Does this sound good to you, to be mindful of our thoughts and the things that we do? We can dream of our future or reflect on our past, but the moment of now is the moment to grasp. So thank you for sharing your right now with me. After all, we are not human doings, we are human beings, you see, so we must make time to simply just be.
This is my guest, Chico, children's book author Josh Shelton. It's illustrated by Sam Polenza, and Josh just read us the third in his series of books, I Am Adventure books, and the title of this one is Just Be. Now, Josh, I'm wondering if you you just came upon these thoughts yourself, mm-hmm. or if you've read Eastern philosophy, because all these are familiar for centuries.
No, this all comes through me. I mean, I've definitely, you know, meditation's been always been a part of my life, or just a deep knowing that to, you know, be able to get a level of enjoyment and navigate all that the systems in our world require of us, that it's an important medicine, just in general, for all walks of life, all religion, you know, whatever religion or whatever you may subscribe to, it's just a human component that's necessary. I mean, human, literally in there, like you're a human being, you know, but we just literally are inundated with massive doing, and you know, one thought leads to another, and before you know it, you know, you're just almost, you know, being tugged around by, you know, your brain, and you're just not grounded. So yeah, I mean, no, this, it's just, you know, yeah, it's a simple concept, everyone knows it, but you know, you have to kind of move into it, and it's very important.
You know, I can just imagine an adult reading this every day.
Yeah,
maybe starting with their day, maybe if they meditate. Yeah. Read yeah. this along yeah. before or after their morning meditation.
No, absolutely. And I think a lot of people, it just becomes overwhelming. Like some people, when they just try to sit and quiet the mind, it's like scary, because it doesn't take much. That's why in here, you know, it's like, what can I do? It's not like it has to be some catastrophic life changing thing you do into your, just integrate it. A couple minutes here, a couple minutes there. Do something different. Take your shoes off and sit down and put them in the grass for 2 minutes. If you haven't done that in the last couple of years, you'd be better off giving it a shot.
Well, and I like the fact that it is rhyming, because I came up with a little rhyme myself.
Oh, I'd love to hear.
I happen to teach people yoga, and awesome. So I came up with, drop your shoulders, lift your chest. That is posture at its best.
It's perfect. It's the truth.
And so if I catch myself, particularly if I see somebody else kind of slumped over,
yeah.
drop your shoulders, lift your chest. That is posture at its best.
Yeah, and then when you do that, you can feel like, I just did it myself.
I just saw you do that.
Well, yeah, because, you know, excitement, I mean, you get kind of, you know, tension, it just builds and you're unaware of it. And people are like, oh, I get headaches all the time. Well, you probably ought to do exactly what you just said. Might help.
So people might select maybe just one or two lines from your poem that you've written, Just Be. We're not human doings. We are human beings, you see. And we must make time to simply just be.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's the title of your third book in the series, I Am Adventure. And you said you've already written a fourth one.
Yeah, it's been written. Yeah, I'm the Drop in the Ocean, it's called, just to plug it. We'll get to work on the art on that in, you know, the coming times, with a goal to get that out in the world in 2026. The first two, they're all poems. They all rhyme. Hey Tree, What Should I Be? I think that was 2017 or 18. And then we did Imagine a World in 2019, which was about 1 year later. And then, you know, what I mentioned earlier, the world kind of went bonkers and we got, you know, distracted, wasn't just being too often. And, you know, a little survival mode, a little this, just, you know, kids, just life happened. And it's time for this one. I think it's right on time. It's right on time for me personally. I think it's right on time for a lot of people, the message in general. And yeah, so we're excited. We're looking here at the proof copies I got. There's a little few small adjustments I need to make, and we're looking to launch this book. May 31st is when it will launch. We are going to do a launch event at the Commons. There'll be details that, you know, you guys can find us all online, and we will carry these books at our usual spots in Chico when it comes time to do that. But yeah, May 31st, you can pre-order them now.
Well, thank you, Josh, for writing this book for all ages, I feel.
Yes.
Again, my guest has been Josh Shelton. The title of his third in the series of I Am Adventure books is entitled Just Be. Thank you, Josh.
Thank you so much.
We're going to take a quick break, and when I come back, I'll be talking to Chico author Gene Hegland, who has written Into the Forest. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My next guest is an avid teacher and frequent presenter at writing workshops and conferences, both in the United States and abroad. Gene Hegland has lived on 55 acres of second growth forest in Northern California and now lives in Chico. She's the author of four novels and a book of creative nonfiction. Today I'm going to ask her about her first novel, Into the Forest, which has been translated into 16 languages, adopted for campus and community-wide reading programs, adapted as a French graphic novel, a Canadian film, and made into a movie, and currently being adapted as an opera. Gene Hegland, welcome.
Thanks very much. It's good to be here.
An opera? Really?
Yeah. Yeah, that's the latest surprise in this unexpected journey. I have just learned that the people, it's some French composers, and they've just premiered an opera of Madame Bovary, and Into the Forest is next.
That is, I think you're really lucky, because so many people who write books and they're contacted or they think their book is going to be made into a movie, and often that doesn't happen.
That doesn't happen.
Yours was made into a movie and an opera.
Yeah. I mean, there were several failed attempts to make it into, you know, there's lots, there's I've been very lucky and very unlucky over the course of my career. But these are definitely wonderful pieces of luck. Yeah.
Well, I was curious, the fact that your book has been turned into a movie, to see, well, what does that movie look like? So I went to YouTube and watched a trailer, a couple of trailers for your movie. And I found it was kind of scary. I found a range of emotions. In fact, the San Francisco Chronicle says this novel, Into the Forest, is a beautifully written and often profoundly moving novel. And I found myself crying sometimes, Jean, when I read your book. Sometimes I would be crying and sometimes I would be scared. So how would you characterize your book for people who might say, I wonder if I want to read that book?
Okay, first of all, just sort of a little plot situation summary. It's set in the near future, ideally about 3 years in advance of whenever you happen to pick up the book. Set in Northern California. The focus is on two very young women, teenage sisters, who have been raised in a forest because their parents wanted to live out in the woods. They're, you know, pretty privileged young white teenage girls, and they are looking forward to leaving the forest and going on with their lives. The older sister wants to be a ballet dancer. The younger sister has ambitions of going to Harvard. And before all this can happen, they end up orphaned and also in a situation where the civilization as we know it has slowly broken down. And that's the background to the novel. And really the focus is on these two young women and the challenges they face and the decisions they make. I'm honored by your tears. I would like to think that it's a novel that explores, you know, really a lot of things that are important to me about human beings' relationship with the natural world, kind of what are the things that matter most to us, particularly in extremity. And I would characterize it, there are scary bits, and there are really sad and tragic and horrible parts. At the same time, to me, it's a novel of hope. It's hard-won hope. It doesn't come easy, but then no real hope ever does. And so, yeah, I think that it's a hopeful book.
My guest is Chico author Jean Hegland, and I'm asking about her first novel. She's written more than one, but this novel is entitled Into the Forest, and it's a was made into a motion picture, a movie. Now, you mentioned two main characters, sisters, but I was thinking, you know, I think there's another character.
Yeah.
Do you know maybe what I'm thinking?
I'm hoping you're going to say the forest.
You're absolutely right.
I'm delighted.
I'm reading your book and I say, yeah, here are two humans that are the main characters, but I think the forest is a main character.
Oh, I love that insight. Thank you. Yeah.
Well, why don't you read us the very start of your novel, Into the Forest, and let us meet the two main characters. And one is told, they're two sisters, but one is the narrator.
Right. She's writing in a journal, and she's 17 years old, and she is beginning to write out the story of what's happening to them during this unusual bit of their lives.
And this journal itself is important to her.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, it becomes...
before she even writes in it.
Right, yeah, yeah. That's what we'll see here. She's trying to come up with her relationship to what it means to be a journal keeper and a story keeper and how she's going to use this. So that's kind of what she's exploring in these couple paragraphs here. It's strange, writing these first words, like leaning down into the musty stillness of a well and seeing my face peer up from the water. So small and from such an unfamiliar angle, I'm startled to realize the reflection is my own. After all this time, a pen feels stiff and awkward in my hand. And I have to admit that this notebook, with its wilderness of blank pages, seems almost more threat than gift. For what can I write here that it will not hurt to remember? You could write about now, Eva said, about this time. This morning, I was so certain I would use this notebook for studying that I had to work to keep from scoffing at her suggestion. But now I see she may be right. Every subject I think of, from economics to meteorology, from anatomy to geography to history, seems to circle around on itself, to lead me unavoidably back to now, to here, today. Today is Christmas Day. I can't avoid that. We've crossed the days off the calendar much too conscientiously to be wrong about the date, however much we might wish we were. Today is Christmas Day, and Christmas Day is one more day to live through, one more day to be endured so that someday soon this time will be behind us. By next Christmas, this will all be over. My sister and I will have regained the lives we are meant to live. The electricity will be back. The phones will work. Planes will fly above our clearing once again. In town, there will be food in the stores and gas at the service stations. Long before next Christmas, we will have indulged in everything we now lack and crave. Soap and shampoo, toilet paper and milk, fresh fruit and meat. My computer will be running. Eva's CD player will be working. We'll be listening to the radio, reading the newspaper, using the internet. Banks and schools and libraries will have reopened. And Eva and I will have left this house where we now live like shipwrecked orphans. She will be dancing with the core of the San Francisco Ballet. I'll have finished my first semester at Harvard. And this wet, dark day the calendar has insisted we call Christmas will be long, long over.
This is my guest, Jean Hegland, reading from her novel, Into the Forest. And as a person who's reading this, thinking, well, this is kind of like COVID, only it's much worse. She says, electricity will be back, so apparently they don't have electricity. Phones will work, so apparently they don't have phone. Planes will fly. All these things that they are lacking, we wonder, why are the circumstances such that they are lacking in so many things? And yet here are these talented girls. The narrator is planning to go to Harvard, and her sister is thinking her sister's so talented as a ballerina that she will be going to San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And it makes me wonder, as I'm reading your book, to what degree this book is autobiographical, because I know you lived in a forest yourself for a number of years, or in many acres. And as I look at you, I thought, yeah, she could be a ballet dancer. And if you're a writer, you must love to read. So I went back and forth, well, maybe she was more like Eva, the dancer. Maybe she was more like Nell, the narrator. So am I wrong about, to some degree, this being autobiographical?
Well, fiction, I think, always comes from three sources. It's a braid of three sources, and it depends on the book, which strand of that braid is the largest. There's experience, there's research, and there's imagination. And they all feed each other, of course. It's interesting how people want to sort of peg down where the story came from. When I was in sixth grade, my ballet teacher told me I really needed to find something else to do.
Oh.
So my experience as a dancer was fairly limited. And so it took a lot of research, that part of it.
Because you use all the ballet terms. I recognize them from my childhood taking ballet. It made me nostalgic for ballet lessons as a child when you're using all these terms of what, because Eva is doing all these ballet moves as they're interacting.
And, you know, this, I was writing this book before internet, so I had to get videos, you know, from the library, and I was watching dance, and so a lot of research there. Definitely my experience with the forest was similar to what the sisters experience in the novel. I had moved from Eastern Washington, where there are no trees, to Northern California, and my husband and I had just moved into a forest out west of Healdsburg when I got the idea for this novel. And I think one of the reasons that I was so interested in this idea was that it allowed me to kind of figure out where I was living. Because at the beginning of my relationship with that forest, I didn't know the names of the plants. I didn't know poison oak. Didn't know, you know. And so I was doing the same kind of research that the sisters end up doing, trying to learn about the place that I lived. And that was very meaningful and important to me, you know, personally. And then it certainly fed into my imagining of their experience.
Well, this kind of reminds me of the sister Nell, because she likes to do research. She goes through the encyclopedias and from A, B, C. And so I'm thinking that that's kind of what you were doing, learning about the forest, were you?
Yeah, I'm not much of an encyclopedia reader.
Well,
though Nell is, and it definitely served its purpose in the novel. But I am an ardent believer at this point in my life that we need to know. All of us need to know a lot more about where we live and find connections, much deeper connections than most of us have had with the places that we live. I think it's one of the few ways we have left of trying to, you know, protect what's left of the world, frankly.
So you lived in this second growth forest, huge, for a long time. So if I may ask, what brought you to Chico?
A fire. It was a mega fire, the Wallbridge fire of 2020. And our home was destroyed, and our 55 acres was very badly burned. And we had a number of reasons for choosing not to rebuild. One of the big ones for me was I did not want to turn my beloved forest into a construction site after it had just endured the damage of the fire. So we have dear family in Chico, and it seemed like a good place to move. We're very fortunate that we've been able to keep our land and have been able to watch it, you know, work on regrowing, and have been able to spend time out there helping it.
This must have been traumatic, not only for you and your husband, but you have three children.
Yeah. They were all, you know, grown and gone, but it was their childhood home. And this happened during COVID, so we weren't able to see each other. So we had, you know, Zooms during which everybody was weeping in their little square from their little place, you know, in America, spread across America.
After a break, I'll be back with author Jean Hegland, whose book is Into the Forest. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Thank you. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with Chico author Gene Hegland, whose book Into the Forest was made into a movie. What do you think was the appeal that this company said, yeah, let's make a movie out of this book?
Who knows? I'm not much of a moviegoer, so I'm probably the last. There's too many books to read. So I'm probably the last person to evaluate that. You know, it's such a huge, cumbersome process, I think, making a movie. And I think there's so many decisions involved. I'd like to think, you know, that there's a lot of drama in this story.
I agree with that.
Visually, you know, yeah. I think it offers a lot of promise. Actually, you know, it had been optioned a number of times, and the options didn't go through. And so when it got optioned again, I was, you know, I mean, I don't believe in any of it until it happens.
Yeah, that's the case that some authors are so close that think, yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, no.
And then it doesn't.
Right.
So I wonder, were you pleased with the result of the movie that was made from your book? Were you pleased with that? Or did you think, they didn't quite get it?
So I did not want to be involved.
I looked for your name, in fact, on the trailer, and I didn't see your name anywhere. I saw the director, but I did not see your name. So that's why.
I was busy writing another novel. My mother was ill, and it was much more important to me to spend time with her. And as I said, I'm not much of a, you know, film goer. And so I didn't know how helpful my experience would be. So I spoke that. It was the actress Elliot Page who, thanks to an independent bookseller in Canada, told her about this book. And she read it and got interested. And so we had a nice long conversation during which she convinced me that she had the novel's best interests at heart. And then I wasn't involved until I showed up at the premiere at the Toronto Film Festival. And sat next to Evan Rachel Wood and watched the premiere. And my reaction was pretty much like my reaction is to any film that I've seen made from a book that I think I know pretty well. You know, there were parts that I thought really pegged it and were really powerful and beautiful and moving, and other parts where I thought, missed the mark. But, I mean, I think that just comes with the territory, doesn't it? An adaptation of a novel to a, you know, less than 2-hour movie. It's going to be its own beast. So,
My guest is novelist Gene Hegland, and I'm asking her about her first novel. She's written more than one, Into the Forest. And you help other people who want to be writers. I mentioned that you're often a presenter at writing workshops and conferences, both here in the United States and abroad. So what kind of helpful hints, if I want to call them that, do you convey when you are asked to be a presenter at a writing workshop?
Well, there's a lot to talk about when you talk about shaping stories. I think probably one of the things that that was most important to me and that I think is very true for other writers is that assume that first drafts aren't final drafts. Embrace revision. Assume that it's going to be a long haul and you have no idea what you're doing to begin with. And that's a great part of the pleasure of the whole enterprise, I think.
In fact, I admire the discipline that it takes to complete a book. Oh, my goodness.
It's a lot of butt work.
Well, why don't we take a look at some more of your novel. And, for example, the section where you mentioned in the first part that they had no electricity. They were looking forward to when it would come back. So in your novel where it says, narrator, Nell, says, last winter when the electricity first began going off,
mm-hmm.
Because this is in the trailer, too. The two sisters are there, and the lights will blink, and oh, gosh.
Yeah.
So would you read that section for us?
Sure, thanks. Last winter, when the electricity first began going off, it was so occasional and brief, we didn't pay much attention. They're probably working on the lines, we'd say, or the rains must have brought a tree down. They'll have the power back soon. And soon enough, the lights would blink on. The washing machine would resume its hum and churn in the utility room. The vacuum cleaner would roar back to life. And a second later, we would be taking electricity for granted once again. For a long time, it was a rare day when the power didn't go off at least once. Finally, it was a rare day when the power came on. At some point, we realized we had lost the habit of groping for the light switch whenever we entered a room. We no longer automatically reached for the knob on the stove when we wanted to cook something, or flung the refrigerator door open when we were hungry. We took the electric blankets off our beds, put the electric coffee maker away, rolled up the carpets we could no longer vacuum. Our father taught us how to trim, fill, and light the kerosene lamps he had once refused to let our mother throw out. And for a time, we lit those when darkness fell. During this time, the mail delivery was becoming more sporadic, and businesses were closed more often. For a few months, state employees were paid with promissory notes until the banks refused to honor the government IOUs, and then they went unpaid altogether. It's amazing how quickly everyone adapted to those changes. I suppose it's like the way people beyond our forest had already gotten used to having to drink bottled water, drive on overcrowded freeways, and deal with the automated voices that answered every telephone. Then, too, they cursed and complained and soon adjusted, almost forgetting their lives had ever been any other way. Maybe it's true that the people who live through the times that becomes history's pivotal points are those least likely to understand them. I wonder if Abraham Lincoln himself could have answered the inevitable test questions about the causes of the Civil War. Once the daily newspapers ceased to appear every morning and radio broadcasts grew more and more sporadic, what news we did get was so fragmentary and conflicting as to tell us almost nothing about what was really happening. Of course there was a war going on. We had moved our mother's radio from her workroom into the kitchen, and before the batteries died last spring, we used to coax it into muttering its litany of disaster while we were fixing dinner. The fighting was taking place half a world away, taking place, the politicians promised, to protect our freedoms, to defend our way of life. It was a distant war, but it seemed to cling to our days, to permeate our awareness like a far-off, nasty smoke. But I think there were other causes, too. Sometime in January, we heard that a paramilitary group had bombed the Golden Gate Bridge. And less than a month later, we read that the overseas currency market had failed. In March, an earthquake caused one of the California nuclear reactors to melt down, and the Mississippi River flooded more violently than had ever been imagined possible. All last winter, the newspapers, when we could get them, were choked with news of ruin, and I wonder if the convergence of all those disasters brought us to this standstill. We learned the United States had a new president, that she was arranging for a loan from the Commonwealth to bail us out. We heard the White House was burning and the National Guard was fighting the Secret Service in the streets of D.C. We heard there was no water left in Los Angeles, that hordes of people were trying to walk north through the drought-ridden Central Valley. We heard that the county to the east of us still had electricity and that the Third World was rallying to send us support. And then we heard that China and Russia were at war and the U.S. had been forgotten.
This is my guest, Jean Hegland, reading from her novel, Into the Forest. Now, Jean, you didn't write this in 2025, but as we read this, we thought, oh my gosh.
It stood up way too well, I'm afraid to say. I mean, I was writing this in the early 90s. And, you know, we had all those things to worry about then, and I think they've, for me, they've become even more frightening now.
Well, in the 80s, my husband in particular thought, you know, we don't know how to grow a garden. Maybe we should move out. And so we looked. We found a place in the mountains, and we were on a stream, and we had solar before people had solar, a solar panel on our deck that heated water. It was built into the side of the mountain, so it was earth-bermed, and there was a waterfall nearby. We could have generated electricity, but by then we thought, okay, we did this. Now let's go back to civilization. But these things that you're writing about make us wonder, because my mail delivery lately hasn't been very reliable, and some of the things that you mentioned, oh, gosh, maybe we should be rethinking our lives.
Yeah, I think we should. And I don't think, I mean, for me, it's not a rethinking like I want to be a prepper and, you know, go out with my gun and defend everybody else. But yeah. I do think that it's crucial for so many reasons. That we need to rethink our methods of consumption. We need to rethink our relationship, you know, with the earth. We need to rethink our relationships with each other. You know, the Pope just died, and I'm not a Catholic, but there were things that I admired about him very, very much, and one was his encyclical about climate change, in which he, for me, just pegged so many of the things that I think are very, very important for us to remember about who we are and how we fit on this planet and what things ultimately matter and which things don't. So, yeah, he was encouraging, he too was encouraging us to rethink.
Yeah. So that's part of the message of your novel, would you say? What's the takeaway? What do you want people to get from when they read your novel? What do you hope they get?
Well, I mean, the wonderful thing about having more than one reader in the world is that everybody gets different things, right?
And yeah. And at different times in their lives.
Exactly.
If I would read this 20, 30 years ago, I think I would see different things than I see now.
Me too. I mean, that's exactly my experience of this. You know, I mean, it's a story we share at this point, and when I go back to it, it looks different. But I mean, one of the questions that I was really that I welcomed writing this book for, because it gave me an opportunity to really explore it, was you know, how might we rethink our relationships to the natural world? Not in a literal way. There's no way this book is can be taken literally. It's a metaphor. It's a fable. But for me, I think it suggests a lot about how we might want to rethink some of those relationships.
Well, kind of along those lines. There's one more section I'd like you to read, if you don't mind, Jean. And that is kind of along the lines of what you were just saying. Our narrator, we have these two sisters, Nell and Eva. So would you read this section about what Nell says about the forest, the trees, and flowers?
Yeah, so this is much, much later in the book. A lot has happened.
Oh, my gosh, yes. But we don't want to spoil it.
No spoilers. I think perhaps just the voice and her insights will suggest all of that. This is what she writes in her journal. Before, I was Nell, and the forest was trees and flowers and bushes. Now, the forest is Toyon, Manzanita, wax myrtle, big-leafed maple, California buckeye, bay, gooseberry, flowering currant, wild ginger, wood rose, red thistle. And I am just a human, another creature in its midst. Gradually, the forest I walk through is becoming mine, not because I own it, but because I'm coming to know it. I see it differently now. I'm beginning to see its variety in the shape of leaves, the organization of petals, the million shades of green. I'm starting to understand its logic and sense its mystery. Everywhere I walk, I try to notice what's around me, a clump of mint, a cluster of fennel, a thicket of manzanita, or a field of amaranth to gather from now or return to later when the need is there or the season is right. Why did we ever buy flowers? Great, gross, hulking things in plastic containers from the buy-and-save parking lot that we watered, fertilized, fenced, and sprayed, and that still finished the summer ragged from slugs and snails and grasshoppers. Why didn't we let the flowers grow where they would, healthy and strong, and in their own time? I wish my mother were alive, so I could tell her that we didn't need those buy-and-save petunias, didn't even need her ring of tulips. Clarkia, columbine, red clintonia, blue-eyed grass. We were surrounded by flowers all the time.
This is my guest, Chico author Jean Hegland. She's reading from her novel Into the Forest that was made into a movie and has been translated into 16 languages. I think people will be amazed at what they get from your book, Jean.
Thank you. Thank you.
We'll look forward to your... You must be writing a novel now.
I'm always working on another book. I'm slow. It takes many drafts.
Well, that was your caution to people. Yeah. Yes. Don't think your first draft will be the last
caution.
One.
Caution. Not encouragement.
Yes, indeed. Again, my guest has been Jean Hegland, and her novel that we've been talking about, her first novel, Into the Forest. Thank you, Jean.
Thank you.
I would also like to thank my first guest, Chico children's book author Josh Shelton, whose latest book is Just Be.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.